I'm Kate Remington. I'm talking with David Amato. He's one of the finalists in the search for the New Haven Symphony Orchestra's new music director. And David, it's really fun to have a chance to talk with you.
Well, likewise, Kate.
You'll be conducting the orchestra on Thursday, April 12th, in Woolsey Hall in New Haven. The program is really interesting because it features a contemporary work by George Santakis and Ravel's Piano Concerto and the Berlioz Symphony Fantastique. And so I guess right off the bat, I'm curious, what was it about the New Haven Symphony Orchestra that made you want to throw your hat in the ring for this position?
I think there are a number of things. The first thing is that it's an orchestra I have heard about ever since I was a kid, and that's because my mom played in it.
Wow.
When she was a student at Yale.
Wow.
She died many years ago. She was a wonderful violinist, and she studied at Yale. She played. She sat with Howard Boatwright on the first stand, and got fired from her job as assistant concertmaster because the story she told was that Solomon, the great British pianist, was playing, and she became so enthralled with his playing that she just didn't pick up her violin. She just listened. And at the end of the performance, I guess she was so enthused by it and so moved that she stood up and she was fired. Like, if you're going to get fired from your job, it might as well be under those kinds of circumstances. I mean, what a great story and what a testament to her, like her ability to totally lose herself in the music. You know, she was gone. You know, she probably did everybody a favor by not playing. So anyway. Warm, in spite of that, she had very warm and fond memories of the orchestra, and that story was a family lore, and so I've always known about the orchestra. And I also am aware of the regional orchestra scene that goes along the whole Eastern Seaboard there from Boston to D.C. and beyond, and how strong it is. We have in this part of the world, we have such an incredibly rich vein of talent that we can mine and really put first-rate orchestras on the stage all over the place. And so, it's very appealing to know that the level of musicianship along that swath of the East Coast is so uniformly strong. And that's certainly the case with the New Haven Symphony.
Yeah, it's a remarkable orchestra. And as you say, I mean, there are some really incredible orchestras all along the Eastern Seaboard, including the Delaware Symphony. And you've been the music director there for 20 years. I mean, that's really amazing because not many conductors these days especially stay with orchestras that long. So what keeps you there as well?
Yeah, so it's I'm in my 15th or 16th season. I stopped counting a while ago. I think what's kept me there is the vitality of what happens on the stage and the pleasure that we all get from finding its place in the community. So I think we've kind of hit a kind of resonant stride there with what we're doing and how it engages the people that we serve. And I think that's very appealing and is a, as there can be downward spirals where you program the wrong thing for the wrong people and you lose money and then you kind of are grasping at straws and you kind of do more of the wrong thing and go down that dark hole, there's a kind of equal and opposite reaction that goes the other way, right? You start to do the right thing for the right people and that begins to feed itself and it becomes as bright and optimistic as that dark hole is kind of gloomy and doom-filled.
Yeah, that's a great analogy, and it's absolutely true. And the program that you've put together for this concert on April 12th is so interesting. The Ravel Piano Concerto with Stuart Goodyear, and then as I mentioned, the George Santakis piece written in 2010, and Berlioz. And so, as you were putting this program together, what was your thought process?
Well, first I realized it was on April 12th, so it's right before Friday the 13th, and it was right before tax time, so I thought we needed something that had, like, witches and scary stuff in it, so, Symphony Fantastique. No, I'm just kidding. I think it's great that the last time I did Symphony Fantastique, it was right before a now famous and very dramatic national election, and so I think that this is, a somehow I do it at times when it seems like it has a larger cultural resonance. But it's a piece I love, Symphonie Fantastique. It's one of the first pieces as a kid that I really got turned on by. I heard we had subscription tickets to the Philadelphia Orchestra. I grew up outside of Philadelphia. And I heard it one night. You know, I went to the orchestra. I had no idea what was going on. And I heard this unbelievable thing with this incredible story that was so appealing to, like, a 12-year-old boy, you know, about unrequited love and despair. And it's so graphic with the guillotine and the, you know, come on, what's not to love? 12, right? And it stuck with me. It was the first CD I ever bought when CDs came out. And it's just been a piece that I've adored. It's so inventive. Berlioz, you know, he pushed all the limits everywhere. He wasn't a particularly good instrumentalist. I guess he played the guitar, kind of, and played the flute, kind of. But he was totally unencumbered by practicality. It didn't matter to him that, you know, this might be weird or difficult or an extended technique or whatever. He just knew that he wanted to kind of have this sound, and so he wrote to get this sound or that sound. He was a kind of early adopter of new technology, like the harp, you know, which was something very different in the later part of the 18th century. By the time the 19th century came around with Erard, there was kind of a newfangled contraption, and he, of course, he uses at least two of them in Fantastique. He was really an innovator. The idea of writing a piece that writing a symphony that wasn't wholly abstract was also kind of a new conceit, right? I mean, this is one of the earliest pieces of real program music. It doesn't just have a kind of abstract narrative. It's got a narrative. It actually tells a story. And so it's got a lot of great hooks, a lot of great appeal. It's tremendously interesting music, colorful music. It's always just a fun piece to bring to an orchestra that you don't have a relationship with, because everyone can kind of bond over just how kind of dramatic and wonderful and over the top the piece is.
That's really interesting. I was going to ask you, in your career as a guest conductor too, what you do so that you can, you know, get on the same page with the orchestra and use the very limited time that you have to kind of, you know, work through things. And so, yeah, of course, the Symphonie Fantastique would be a great way to, kind of a great icebreaker, I guess.
Yeah, it's such a wild piece. And, you know, the whole program is really about, in a way, about kind of innovation. As all three of these composers are extraordinarily imaginative and innovative in different ways, and all three of them take elements from outside of the kind of normal toolbox of classical music and infuse their own pieces with it. So, you know, Berlioz takes this idea of a story, of a narrative, about this guy who's, you know, desperately lovesick and goes to an opium den and has these totally whacked out dreams. That's the basic story. Ravel relies, I think, pretty heavily on elements of jazz in his piano concerto. And then George Santakis in Laconica limits each of the movement's lengths, of which there are five, to the length of a pop song, as a kind of a creative corset, you know, something to sort of bind him in a place that forces him to do certain things quickly and effectively. And so each of them reach outside of the normal palette of classical music to kind of get inspiration and information.
That's a really interesting way of combining things. And obviously, they each came to the final result in different ways. And let's talk a little bit about Laconica, because it's a piece that, honestly, I wasn't familiar with, but I love that, you know, the title is kind of a play on the name of the L.A. Chamber Orchestra for whom it was written, and I'm wondering how you discovered it.
I was conducting at a music festival a bunch of years back, and he was a visiting composer, and I was sort of handed the score and said, you know, here, do this. And I actually knew George from a long time ago, when I was a pianist. I went many, many summers to the Aspen Music Festival as a pianist. And I took a, one summer I took a, an ear training class for composers and conductors, which was just comically difficult. And George taught it. And he was a terror. And he made us do the most impossibly difficult thing. I couldn't do them. You know, there's one kid in the class who could do it, of course. There's always one, right? But I was not that one. And then when I did this piece and I met George, I reminded him of this. And he, of course, he didn't remember. And I told him what he made us do. And he's like, I couldn't do that. So I, that was great. Anyway, so, yeah, I got to do this piece at a festival. And I fell in love with it. It's a really interesting piece. It's got five movements, which are all, from a kind of, like, mood and ambiance standpoint, they're all quite different. But they're linked, they're motivically linked, and they're kind of, they form a kind of a single gesture when viewed all together. And I really sort of responded to how carefully crafted the piece was. It reminded me, in fact, a lot of Ravel, whose music is equally crafted and wrought. And I got to do it again on another occasion, and it just seemed like a wonderful match from a kind of coloristic standpoint, from this idea of, you know, using pop music time restrictions compared to Ravel and jazz and Berlioz and narrative. It seemed like it was kind of a thematic fit. And it was a piece that by a composer that I think people need to know, just like they need to know Ravel and Berlioz. They need to know Tsontakis. And he's going to be there on the 12th.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
I think it's also great that it's part of a, you know, it seems like the pendulum is swinging back in contemporary music, and composers are writing music that's a lot more accessible than it was even 20 years ago or so. And so I think if people are wary of listening to music by a contemporary composer, this would be a great way to kind of bring them back to the fold.
I think that that's right. And I think we, you know, bad memories last longer than good memories, it seems. And I think that post-World War II music scene became so heavily reliant on academic music. And I think it really gave audiences a certain set of impressions about what new music was, which lasted well past when that was the reality. I think composers, you know, since the 80s have been, well, forever, I guess. Composers basically want to write music that people want to listen to, you know. Largely, these are people who are trying to write something that speaks to an audience member, right, that somehow moves them, somehow resonates within them. And my piano teacher at Juilliard would say, when I would make some comment about Bach being a Baroque composer, he said, yes, but all composers are romantic composers. As if to say, all composers are trying to touch you somehow. You know, they may be doing it with the trappings of Baroque language and gesture, or, you know, with 12-tone language and gesture, but they're trying to move you. And I think that composers and audiences are both kind of understanding and embracing that notion. Certainly George does.
Yeah, it's an exciting time to listen to contemporary music. And honestly, if you think about it, people hear more contemporary music than they might think, because it's all around them in films and video games, and then also in the concert hall. So no reason to be scared.
Totally agree.
And let's talk a little bit about the soloist in the Ravel, Stuart Goodyear. He is just phenomenal. I mean, he just, like, takes everything in his stride. Have you had a chance to work with him before?
I have. I've worked with him a bunch. I think, and I agree with you, I think phenomenal is exactly what he is. I think that sometimes that's a stretch of a word to describe certain people, but not Stuart. He is a musician of extraordinary ability, of monumental intellect, and a pianist for whom technical difficulties just don't exist. You know, he can do it all. And he's such an interesting and thoughtful musician. He brings a kind of a thoroughness and a rigor to his approach to whatever it is he's playing. And it's always a treat to work with him, because I always feel like I'm learning something. You know, he always kind of opens my eyes and opens my ears to something that I thought I had really known well. And that's a real gift.
Yeah, definitely. And you mentioned that you had studied at Juilliard. Was piano your primary instrument as well?
Yeah, I played the piano from a very early age. I went to Juilliard pre-college, and then I went to, after 1 year at University of Pennsylvania, I transferred to Juilliard and got my undergraduate degree in piano performance. And then I switched to conducting, went to the dark side.
Well, what was it that sort of kind of opened the door to make you want to be a conductor?
You know, I don't think it was one thing, as is the case so often in life, right? It's usually a kind of confluence of circumstance. And I think that when I went to college as a pianist, I began to understand that that there were really an incredible number of great pianists, like really great pianists. And even though I was pretty good, I wasn't one of those great pianists. And I sort of tried to imagine what my life would look like as a pianist, and my sort of commitment to the instrument, and kind of began to examine all this stuff. And I realized that piano felt more like a tool to me. It felt more like a means to an as-yet-to-be-determined end.
Hmm.
I had a class that I took as an undergrad. It was called Keyboard Skills. It was a 2-year class, and there were three of us in the class. And we learned to do all this stuff at the piano, like score read and transpose songs and sight reading. And it was keyboard skills, like playing figured bass, learned how to do all that. And I really loved it. And I felt like, yeah, you know, there's something in here for me. And at the same time, I met this girl, and she played in the orchestra, and so I was hanging out at rehearsals, and I subsequently married her. So, and we're still married, so I can still tell you that story. And I think I just kind of got really engaged in not just the repertoire, which I guess I'd always loved, the orchestra repertoire, but in the sort of process of how pieces are put together, about how an orchestra works. I mean, it's a big organism. And as a pianist, we're kind of on the other end of the spectrum. You know, we sit at a keyboard in a room by ourselves, right? There's none of that social dynamic that is so primary in how an orchestra functions. And so that was really fascinating to me. And I decided to give it a try. You know, I didn't really know what I was getting into. And it seemed to stick.
Wow, that's amazing. That is a big jump. I was a piano major in college, too, and kind of came to the same conclusion that there's just no spark there, and that's how I ended up in radio, which it has been amazing, too. But you're right. I mean, if you don't have the right attitude and the right gift to carry forward as an instrumentalist, then it is good to explore other options. And you've got some notable musicians in your family. Your grandmother was the violinist Lillian Fuchs, and your great uncle was also a violinist, Josef Fuchs. And so was it always kind of a foregone conclusion that you'd have a career in music?
Probably. I didn't ever feel like I was being pushed into something, but it was certainly made clear to me that it was the door was held open. I was not pushed through the door, but it was held wide open. And I think, you know, because I had so many string players in my family, and my mom was a violinist, and my aunt's a cellist, and my other great uncle was a cellist, I think I wisely chose the piano, because, you know, who wants to be around all those string players, and they're going to need a pianist? A practical decision. Already, you know, even then I was thinking the piano is a tool. How can I escape string player torment and help out?
David, it's going to be so much fun to hear what you do with the New Haven Symphony Orchestra. We're all looking forward to it. And thank you so much for taking some time to talk.
Kate, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.